Nicola Benedetti with the London Symphony Orchestra and Daniel Harding in the Meditation from Thais by Massenet. Our last musical offering for you today. Plenty more to come tomorrow. The Badgo Quartet playing live for us. And Matthew Trusler, Thomas Carr and Ashley Wass performing as well. I'll be talking to Valery Gergiev from the Royal Albert Hall. He's got a prom tomorrow night. Speaking of which, it is 7 o'clock now and time to go live tonight to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's proms and another proms first.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. I'm Susie Klein and a warm welcome to all our listeners on the BBC Asian Network.
I'm Bobby Fritchin. Welcome to all our listeners on BBC Radio 3. This is actually a historic link-up between both of our radio stations. It's never happened before. A chance for us to all come together for a shared musical experience.
Well, we are live here at the Royal Albert Hall, as always, and the players of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales on stage, they are here tonight with conductor David Atherton.
And for all our BBC Asian Network listeners, maybe a bit more used to lots of Bollywood at this time, well, actually, this is a one-off special show. You're going to hear classical music, classical Western, as well as a concerto of classical Indian music with the sitar maestro Nishat Khan.
We heard this piece, the two of us, in rehearsals this morning, Bobby. So exciting. I thought a fantastic meeting of Asian and European musical traditions.
Definitely a meeting of both those traditions. And I think also, for me at least, something I've only ever actually heard on film or in a studio, but never live before in a place like this.
Yeah, I mean, the two of us sitting right next to the orchestra, in fact, next to the double basses, with our ears nearly bleeding, because some of the music that we're going to hear at the top of tonight's show is actually rather loud. And it's just, you get this kind of in your guts, really visceral excitement to sit next to an orchestra like that. And we open tonight with music by Gustav Holst, which we also heard opened rehearsals today. He was a composer who was just so interested in India, in Sanskrit. He actually taught himself Sanskrit in the 1890s.
Well, considering the language itself, I don't think it's spoken by any living person in India unless they're an academic. You know, props to the man.
As they would have said in the 1890s. When there was, I suppose, it's, you know, it's the high point of empire. It's Britain looking to India, this fascination with what was then known as Orientalism. Doesn't sound very Indian to me, though, this piece.
It doesn't sound very Indian, but I think for what we're going to hear later on, in terms of morphing between the Western classical tradition and the Indian classical tradition, it's a great introduction, especially for our listeners who might not be au fait with a lot of classical music of either culture.
Well, applause now for tonight's conductor, David Atherton, joining the players of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, led tonight by Leslie Hatfield. It's Gustav Holst's piece, Indra, to open tonight's live prom.
a Susie Klein. And this is a special simulcast between the BBC Asian Network and BBC Radio 3. And you are listening to Holt's piece of music, Indira. Now, you may not have heard any Indian music inherent within that piece of music, but according to Holt's own programme notes, the work was based on a story from the ancient Sanskrit text, the Rig Veda, and it seeks to portray Indra, the ancient Hindu god of rain and storm, in a struggle with a dragon.
I'm not sure I heard any of that, but still a fantastic piece, great showcase for this orchestra, and great to have you with us live at the BBC Proms. Well, next up this evening, we have a world first. It's Nishat Khan's concerto. I mean, Bobby, one of the world's leading sitar players. Incredibly exciting to have him here at the Proms. It's not his first ever gig here, but it's certainly his first ever concerto.
It's definitely his first concerto, and it's the first concerto where he's taking centre stage. As we spoke to him earlier on, you'll remember, he said it was 20 years in the making as a piece of music. He's actually called the piece The Gate of the Moon.
And we asked him earlier how and why he'd chosen such an evocative title.
I live in this beautiful space in Los Angeles, and the moonrise there is just so gorgeous. And I've always been attracted to the whole idea of this atmosphere of the moon. And so when I thought of this concerto and the way it developed, it's like, you know, the first light of the evening comes through, and there's this moon there, and the darkness is still coming through, and the congregation of us going from this sphere to the next sphere, and that is a sphere of the light. So it's metaphorically done, like, more in terms of the light, and I weaved a little love story around it. It's the meeting of people, and then this man meets this woman, and then there's a courtship, and the woman goes away, and the man follows her. So, and it builds up basically through this whole movements of the five sections in the concerto. Yes, that's how it happened, The Gate of the Moon.
As a musician, and also specifically as an Indian classical musician, what are your thoughts about the space itself, the Royal Albert Hall?
Well, this is the fourth time I'm playing. I'm privileged to be playing in this hall. It's every time, it is just an incredible feeling, because it's the best place you can play in the world. It is also the grandeur of England and Britain, and there's something about, there's a lot of nostalgia which I feel when I come here. And in fact, I wanted to mention also that I dedicated this concerto actually to two people. One is my father, and the other one is the people of Britain, because I have had a wonderful, wonderful time here, and there are different things in the culture which you will hear a lot within the framework of the music and stuff.
There will be a lot of people listening to the BBC Asian Network tonight who live on a diet of Bollywood and nothing else.
Fantastic.
Is there anything you want to say to them about your piece tonight?
Oh, yes. First of all, I'm delighted to play for all of you, and thank you for giving me this opportunity, BBC. I'd like to tell you that in this concerto, there is a lot of influences in this. Not only it is classical Indian music, it is with classical Western music that you hear a lot in the Bollywood cinema as well. And there are lots of elements of melodic structures which you will find very, very close to in terms of its percussion, in terms of its getting together. It's almost like some places like our songs. And so I think they will enjoy this journey. And I'm looking forward to hearing what they think.
That was tonight's maestro, Nishat Khan, talking to me and to Bobby Friction earlier today here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Now, his connection with the UK is something he's had for many, many years. He currently lives in America, in Los Angeles, from the city of Calcutta in India. But he talked at length earlier on about his connection with the classical musical audiences in the UK, the Asian community in the UK as well, and how much his music's appreciated by people here.
Yes, I mean, he told us, you know, he dedicated this concerto to his father, his great mentor, but also to the people of Britain, which I thought was so touching. He obviously has this really deep emotional connection. And here he is coming on stage to very warm applause, Nishat Khan, and tonight's conductor, David Atherton. Nishat Khan bowing first of all towards the audience and then towards tonight's players in the BBC National Orchestra of Wales.
Okay, I think he's going to be tuning his sitar just to get everything entirely correct for everybody. For those listening in right now, if you don't know much about sitar players, he's definitely a huge figure in the world of Indian classical music, and definitely someone in the mold of someone like Ravi Shankar, in the sense that he's not a purist at all, like Ravi wasn't. Ravi went and took Indian classical music via the 60s, via festivals like Monterey, people like George Harrison, to Western audiences. And this is something that Nishat is also doing and has been doing for many years. Worked with people like Philip Glass. He's also appeared on stage with people like Eric Clapton as well.
And as he tunes here, he's come on stage wearing a rather fetching ensemble, just taking the jacket off to reveal a little flash of red silk on the collar and the shoulders. Very dramatic. And on a podium next to tonight's conductor, as he sits on the carpet, we saw the specially rolled up carpet carried on earlier.
Of course, a beautiful carpet is, but obviously this isn't a show about carpets. For those listening, in terms of classical Indian music, I think it's about to start.
That was the world premiere of Nishat Khan's first sitar concerto, The Gate of the Moon. We heard it live here at the BBC Proms and here on BBC Radio 3 and BBC Asian Network.
Now, Susie, some of the things that really struck me about today, because it was my first prom, was the fact that I'd never thought a sitar, that one instrument, would be able to hold its own with a full orchestra. But it danced in and out of the music. It was on top of the music. It existed below the music as well. And that's testament to the power of this man.
I think both to his power as a composer and also as a performer. He told us earlier today he wasn't remotely worried about performing. He was very worried about how the audience here would take it. He desperately wanted people to appreciate the spirit, the generosity of spirit with which he'd intended it. Played here brilliantly, I thought, tonight by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, led by Leslie Hatfield. And also worth saying, a fabulous orchestration, I think. Pete Stacey, who orchestrated that concerto, brilliant, glistening sound from the orchestra.
I think also, for Nishat, the one thing we don't realise, he was really working outside of his own Indian classical comfort zone. And I think that's what he was worried about earlier on when he was talking about actually bringing this to the people in this hall tonight.
I mean, I felt, given that he is one of the world's leading exponents of this instrument, such a humble and generous-spirited man. He really wanted, he cared very much if people liked and enjoyed this piece. As we said earlier, 20 years in the making, there's a little bit of his heart in this, or a big bit.
And as he also said earlier on, he wanted people, the kinds of people who might listen to the Asian Network, to be able to connect with a piece of music like this, even if they didn't necessarily listen to classical music. And I think he may have done that as well tonight.
It was about, for him, he said, and here he comes back on stage full of smiles now. I think he's pretty happy with how it went, shall we say. Back on stage with David Atherton, tonight's conductor, and Nishat Khan giving very warm applause to the orchestra. Such a generous musician. But that brilliant fusion there of Indian classical music, he said, influences of Bach and Mozart and Beethoven, an Indian popular song, and none of it forced, all of it just coming sort of filtered through his experience and his instinct, his love for all that music.
As a fan of popular music in India as well, I could hear exactly what he was talking about. There were elements, dare I say it, of some Bollywood compositions going into that piece, even though that's most probably a heresy for some people listening right now.
Could never, ever be a heresy. It's interval time here at the Royal Albert Hall, and also, rather sadly, time to bid goodbye to Mr. Bobby Friction and to the Asian Network. It was your first experience of proms. It was a good experience?
It was a good experience, which I will repeat again next year, hopefully with you again, Susie.
I'm formally asking you back. I don't know if anybody else approves of that, but we would love to have you back. What was the thing I want to know that really struck you about today as a kind of newbie to the proms? Was there anything that felt particularly exciting about being here?
Yeah, look, I'm a fan of live music. I'm a fan of live rock music and many other types of music. To me, selling this to a rock fan, a fan of popular music, I'd say, you think some live guitarists on stage are brilliant? Come and see a full orchestra on stage. You don't have to be a fan of classical music to just feel the power, the gut power of a live band, a live orchestra on stage. So I'm actually going to start preaching the gospel from tomorrow.
Good, we want as many converts as possible. And I love the idea of that Venn diagram between BBC Radio 3 listeners, BBC Asian Network, and all of those people with their very different musical interests, some of them shared musical interests, enjoying that kind of descending on tonight's concert as a way into kind of new musical avenues potentially for everybody.
So BBC 3 listeners, or should I say BBC Radio 3 listeners, you know where the BBC Asian Network is. It's a beautiful digital station that exists somewhere in your hearts and heads, hopefully.
Oh, stop plugging your station. That's enough. We'll see you next year. Great to have you here, Bobby. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susie. Now back for our BBC Asian Network listeners to Anushka on the BBC Asian Network.
Meanwhile, here on Radio 3, our thanks again to Bobby Friction. Fantastic to have you here with us this evening. And Radio 3 listeners, do not go anywhere. We have more coming up after the interval here at the Royal Albert Hall. It's going to be Vaughan Williams' Second Symphony, his London Symphony. And that is the subject of our Proms Plus event, recorded earlier on this evening across the road at the Royal College of Music, where the presenter was Louise Fryer.
Vaughan Williams' Second Symphony, a London Symphony, was completed 100 years ago this year. And to discuss it, I'm joined by Dr. Kate Kennedy from Girton College, Cambridge, who's a specialist in earlier 20th century poetry and music and also a freelance cellist, and by Stephen Johnson, who coincidentally started out playing the cello. He's recently moved to piano, but he's better known as a writer and a broadcaster with a limitless knowledge of music on just about everything from every time and place. His documentary on Vaughan Williams in 2008 received a Gold Sony Award. Now, Vaughan Williams significantly revised his symphony over a period of 20 years, not least making it at least 10 minutes shorter. And it's that revised version that we're going to be hearing tonight. Four movements, fast, slow, scherzo, and finale. And it's interesting that he uses actual sounds of London in the symphony. Was his intention to be straightforwardly pictorial, or is there more to it than that?
I think there's so much more to it than that. I think this is more than program music, not to belittle program music, but it's doing something different. This is a symphony by a Londoner for London. And I think what he's trying to do, in keeping with many other artists and intellectuals in different genres and different mediums at the time, is to give a snapshot of Edwardian London and what it actually felt like to be part of the society, and trying to give us some kind of sense reflected back to ourselves as a contemporary audience of where Edwardian London and Edwardian Britain was at this particular very critical point just before the outbreak of the First World War. I mean, the decade leading up to the war has been described as a long garden party. And in some senses, there was that sense of calm and stillness. But actually, to Vaughan Williams living through that, this was a sense of a doomed calm. It was a stillness that was to be shattered. And we have to struggle to get that sense, I think, when we look back retrospectively, knowing the Armageddon that was to come. But there were, H.G. Wells describes it as a sense of a strained optimism. There were structures, beliefs, you know, the role of women, all these things that had somehow ossified under Queen Victoria's very long reign. And so there were violent factions pushing for change. We have suffragettes, you know, putting jam in letterboxes, throwing themselves under racehorses. We had the Cat and Mouse Act, the violent opposition to change. And so this was a sense of calm that really couldn't last. And in a lot of work at the time, we get a sense that intellectuals are aware that this is about to change, that there is a sense of decay, there is a sense that there's something very worthwhile that ought to be held onto, but that also all this is crumbling around us. And so what Vaughan Williams is doing, rather than giving us, you know, a jolly tromp through London, and you know, here we are passing Westminster Chimes, and here's a Cockney chap whistling, it's infinitely more than that. It's all sorts of aspects of what it means to be in London, what it means to be British at this time.
What does he pick out musically to create that sense of an underclass, of the kind of darker, seedier side of London?
Well, that's interesting, because this is by far Vaughan Williams' most revised symphony. And a lot of the revision had to do with tightening it up structurally. But in some ways, he actually muted that slight, that dark message. If you listen to the original version of the symphony, which is now available in a recording, there's a lot more of the darkness and the strangeness and the sense of alienation even in that. Particularly, there's a bizarre and extraordinary passage at the heart of the scherzo, which is about 4 or 5 minutes long, which he actually removed wholesale. Fascinatingly, there was almost a campaign at the time to get him to put it back. Arnold Bax wrote him a letter, the composer, begging him to return this passage to the symphony.
There actually was a public campaign. There were people writing into the Musical Times and Music and Criticism saying, you know, I really like this bit when I first heard it. Where's it gone?
It is a moment when suddenly London turns on its dark side. Mm. We'll be turning to H.G. Wells' novel Tono Bungay and the relevance of that later, but H.G. Wells has his character in this. He talks about the constant sense of the terror of the grim underside of London. And underneath all this seeming Cockney merrymaking, which Vaughan Williams himself said is the music of the slums, the south side of the river, suddenly the scherzo turns much darker, and there's some very strange writing of a kind that, if you know the symphony well, it's rather surprising to hear.
Absolutely. And following on from that quote from Wells, I mean, George Butterworth, the wonderful, promising young composer who was here at the Royal College, who was killed on the Somme, was a great friend of Vaughan Williams and gave him the idea to write this symphony, talks about the final movement as being a kind of grim struggle, a delight in the struggle with imperfection. There's something about that. There's something almost delighting in this darkness. but also absolutely embracing it and presenting it to us. And I think there's so much darkness in the symphony that perhaps Vaughan Williams felt that he needed to balance it somehow, because although, as you say, it is a much darker work without the cuts, there's ample darkness there left in these wonderful sort of grim, solitary moments, particularly in the epilogue.
Mm. Well, we have just an opportunity now to hear a little bit from the bit of the scherzo that was excised. So this is as dark as it could have got.
Yes, it's very, very striking there. Vaughan Williams has different instruments playing in different keys at the same time, which would have been a very radical sound indeed in London in 1911. Mm. Extraordinary.
Absolutely.
And then he decided to edit it out after his own experiences in the First World War, and as you say, after George Butterworth was killed in the war. Do you think that's why there was an element of he just couldn't face looking back at it?
I don't think so. I think it might have affected how he would have written from then onwards. I don't think he would have edited the darkness retrospectively out of his work. I think probably more prosaically it is to do with a matter of balance. When he did, it was 50 minutes long, it was too long, and he did go round after the premiere asking his friends what he ought to cut out, which is wonderfully Vaughan Williams and wonderfully modest. And I don't know why he would have chosen to cut such an emotional... He sort of cuts the heart out of this movement in a way, doesn't he? It seems a strange edit.
It's the one cut I wish he hadn't made.
Yes.
But it is interesting. I think that the whole process about how the symphony changed as he revised it over quite a long period, by the time he finished, I think this is in the 1930s, mm-hmm. his ideal of the symphony had changed. He'd really embraced Sibelius, the idea of a concentration, economy, of a symphony with a very strong sense of purpose. Yep. Was now central to his own idea of the symphony. At the time he wrote the London Symphony, and this is interesting because I don't know how much Mahler he knew, I don't think it could have been very much,
No. But
his concept of the symphony seems to be here very much Mahlerian. The symphony must be like the world, it must embrace everything, Mahler famously said. This is what he seems to be doing in the London Symphony. And it's, I think his main preoccupation was that he'd gone too far, he felt, in later years, and that actually he had to bring this symphony in line with his later symphonic thinking. I think on the whole he did it extremely well, mm-hmm. except, as you say, it's
this
a terrible shame about
that
passage in the scherzo.
Yeah,
but he was very keen to promote the idea of an English symphony, to become a composer of English symphonies.
And I think it's interesting, for a start, that he chooses a symphony. And as I say, Butterworth encouraged him to turn some sort of sketches that he had about London into it, to throw them into symphonic form, as he puts it. But in a sense, despite the fact that we have Sibelius and we have Shostakovich and we have Walton, people who are pushing the symphony forwards in the 20th century, it still has the feel at this time of being an old form. And what Vaughan Williams is wanting to say is absolutely contemporary and very new. So I think what he's taking is this idea of inclusion that you mentioned, this, because essentially what a symphony is a work that offers a number of different ideas within a cohesive large-scale structure, something like a novel, which is something I'll come on to. But I think it fits perfectly, this idea of inclusion. But what he wants to do, and he sets it out very interestingly in a sort of manifesto in 1912, so 2 years before this premiere, is to write something that is inclusive, that, as I said, is for the people, is presenting London back to Londoners so that they can hear the sounds anew, and they can hear them raised up and made beautiful. He's wonderful at transmuting, at sort of changing ugliness into something beautiful. And so you have to be inclusive. You can't edit things out. You know, something that Virginia Woolf would balk at putting in a novel, Vaughan Williams will pile into a symphony. You know, we have the jingle of hansom cabs, and we have, you know, the Cockney whistling and the barrel organ and all these sounds. And he writes in the Royal College magazine in 1912, a lovely little article saying, it's all very well listening to foreign composers, but, you know, second-hand clothes tend not to fit very well, and things that flourish in foreign soil don't tend to do terribly well in native soil. And what you need to do, interestingly and very pertinently, is not necessarily just look to folk song for an English and inverted commas sound, but to take what you hear around you, to take the sounds in the street, to take what it sounds like to be English and transmute it into something very beautiful. And I think that's absolutely what he's achieved with the London Symphony.
He's also very keen to create a kind of symphony that's not Germanic.
Absolutely.
Because he felt that music, Elgar, much as he admired Elgar, he felt that Elgar was in the German tradition. And it's fascinating, if you look at critical reactions to Elgar's music before the First World War, some of his works were more enthusiastically received in Germany than they were here. Like, I have a copy of a score of a work called Der Traum des Gerontius. And when Strauss called Elgar the first English Meister, he didn't mean he's very good, he meant he's one of us. And that's something that you find in the German reviews of Elgar, this recognition that this is someone who's writing in our tradition and is good at it, which is very interesting if you compare to what happened later. Vaughan Williams felt it was very necessary to get away from German models. The German composer he revered was Bach. After that, he had great difficulty with a lot of the German figures, like Beethoven. He had a love-hate relationship with them. So, you know, it's very much about positioning himself in a different kind, or even inventing a tradition. Of course, he didn't know that Mahler was doing the same thing at the time, partly because in Vaughan Williams's time, Mahler was better known as a great conductor who also composed. Now we think of it the other way around, but actually, you know, it was Mahler conducting Tristan that had bowled Vaughan Williams over as a teenager, so yeah. He would have remembered Mahler preeminently as a conductor.
Now, he described this as his favourite symphony. Why do you think that was? What is there in this symphony to make it so satisfying for him?
I think it's just so full of life. And we've really got to bring in this question of this novel we've both been straining to mention here.
Absolutely. But
Vaughan Williams said that the end of the symphony was inspired by the closing pages of this novel by H.G. Wells called Tono Bungay, which is a kind of miracle cure-all tonic, which is actually basically worthless. It's a kind of parable about promotion and advertising and the way that you sell the product being more important than the product. But London is very much a character in Tono Bungay. In fact, approaching the last pages of the novel, Wells says, we now approach the great last movement in the London Symphony, which can't have escaped Vaughan Williams' attention. But there's a description where Wells says, the whole inimitable place teemed with suggestions of indefinite and sometimes outrageous possibilities of hidden but magnificent meanings. And you can see, almost being Vaughan Williams' motto for this symphony, as also, the characters remark about the narrators remark about the terror of the grim underside of London. That's there too. The novel is absolutely full of phrases which, if you know Vaughan Williams' writing, you realise made a huge impression on him. There's a classic one, a marvellous one, where someone asked him what he thought of composing, and he replied, "It's a rum go." At the climax of the novel, one of the leading characters, Aunt Susan, says to the hero, "Life, it's a rum go." And so, you know, for people who know Vaughan Williams and his writings and his work, reading this novel is a bit of there's an aha on every other page.
Yes, absolutely.
It's absolutely fascinating.
And there are so many wonderful parallels between the two. I think this idea of inclusivity, Wells is absolutely an inclusive writer, and he's very much criticised, particularly by the Bloomsbury Group, for it. He will put everything in there. He'll put the details of how to make some kind of nasty chemical. He'll put really quite dull details about machinery and mechanics. All sorts of things that would not be suitable for a novel go in, and it somehow works. And what he sets out quite self-consciously over and over again in Tono Bungay is the idea of writing a condition of England novel. I'm the central character, but really I'm more about decay, he says, of his central character. And England is about decay. London is decaying before my eyes. This is the rise and fall of a business empire.
The broad, but slow decay of the great social organism of England.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is a social organism in decay. Absolutely right. Mm. And this is what I mean about, you know, intellectuals all perceiving this kind of trajectory downwards before 1914, and Vaughan Williams' symphony is part of that. And it's rather fun to read the symphony as a novel, as a Condition of England novel, and to read Tono Bungay as a symphony, as it tells us it is. It's a London symphony. And Vaughan Williams makes this parallel explicit for us because when he's talking about the epilogue to his real London symphony, he quotes his own précis of the last few pages of Tono Bungay. It's an extraordinary ending to the book where the central character is going down the Thames on a destroyer that he's built himself. And of course, the significance of a destroyer, even though this is 1909, is clear. And he's passing the facades of the buildings. He's passing through Westminster. He's passing the Tower of London. He's passing St. Paul's, the history, along with the great big, ugly, dirty warehouses, and moving out to sea and out to the unknown region, really. And as he passes everything, he muses on what this all means. You know, where is society going? Where is Edwardian London going? And I'd just like to quote the passage that Vaughan Williams paraphrases from this. Rather sweetly, he includes his own address in it, because, as I say, when Wells is moving down the Thames, he cites all sorts of all sorts of tourist attractions and all sorts of things. But Vaughan Williams was living quite near Westminster and Cheyne Walk, so he includes the little bit with Cheyne Walk, which I think is rather lovely, because it gives us a sense that this is actually a walk. He's gone back to his own front door, in a sense. So Vaughan Williams writes, "To run down the Thames is to run one's hand over the pages in the Book of England from end to end. There come first squalid stretches of mean homes right and left, and then the dingy industrialism of the south side. And on the north bank, the polite, long front of nice houses, artistic, literary, administrative people's residences, that stretches from Cheyne Walk nearly to Westminster and hides a wilderness of slums. We tear into the great spaces of the future, and the turbines fall to talking and unfamiliar tongues. Out to the open we go, to windy freedom and trackless ways. Light after light goes down. England and the kingdom, Britain and the empire, the old prides and the old devotions glide abeam, astern, sink down upon the horizon, pass, pass. The river passes, London passes. England passes."
Stephen, what do you think he wanted us to feel at the end of the symphony?
Even though he in some ways tidied it up a bit when he revised it, he still left one very important question mark in at the very end. The final sound you hear in the symphony is one of those beautifully scored, ethereal, big chords, like the chord that opens the Thales Fantasia or the one that ends the Ninth Symphony, which he could score so beautifully, which is like ebbing and flowing of light.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet before that, muted on the brass, you hear the cry, that anguished cry from the beginning of the finale one last time, and it doesn't resolve. The chord doesn't actually resolve the tension in that, so that you're left, despite the beauty of the last chord, with the question mark still hanging in the air. This reminds me of another novel that I can't help hearing as in the background, however distantly, in the London Symphony, which is Conrad's Heart of Darkness, which has a fascinating ending, where the narrator Marlowe comes back from Africa to confront Mr. Kurtz, his fiancé. And as he leaves, disturbed by this encounter, he sees a great black cloud over London. And it leaves you with the question, where is the heart of darkness? Is it Africa, or is it actually here at the heart of what we call civilization? Yeah. Wells himself was tormented by similar questions. He once described history as a race between education and destruction. And therefore, Williams, I think, was very acutely aware of that precarious balance too. And even in the revised version, that question is still left at the end there in that muted chords on the brass. It's not a full resolution. It's not a serene winding down like the end of the Fifth Symphony. It is a highly ambiguous ending.
It is. England passes, isn't it? London passes. It passes. But what is this wide open dark sea that's in front of us? And this premiere was in March 1914. By August 1914, Vaughan Williams was trying to work out how to sign up for the war. And Ford Madox Ford, a sort of contemporary writer and soldier, described the war as being a crack in the table of history, which is a brilliant image, I think. And of course, we can't possibly read the war backwards into what Vaughan Williams is writing in 1913-14. But I think there is very much a sense that nothing is about to be the same again, and that to resolve something satisfactorily at this point would simply be a lie in the teeth, as it's been described. It's not possible to write with a sense of certainty at this point in time and to be honest about what the state of England really is.
Dr. Kate Kennedy, Stephen Johnson, thank you very much.
That was Louise Fryer. Well, a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Susie Klein. If you've just joined us, you have missed the world premiere of Nishat Khan's first sitar concerto. Don't worry, though, you can catch it again on the iPlayer. Right now, though, it is on with the next instalment of this live prom, and it's music by Vaughan Williams, as we just heard in the interval. It'll be his London Symphony next here at the proms. A portrait of the city in four movements. It all starts very quietly, all a bit nocturnal, and then we hear the recognisable chimes of Big Ben. Then we're off to Bloomsbury Square, Westminster Embankment and the Strand. Finally, those chimes of Big Ben again. It's a mix, I suppose, of the big picture postcard iconic symbols of London, mixed in with little vignettes of London life, like the cries of the lavender seller. So the players of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, seated on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall, led tonight by Leslie Hatfield, and joined now on stage by tonight's conductor, David Atherton, for a live performance at the Proms of Vaughan Williams' London Symphony.
Thank you.
Music by Ray Vaughan Williams, a composer so often thought of, sometimes even dismissed as a pastoral composer. Certainly a great poet of the natural world, if you think of pieces like The Lark Ascending or The Sea Symphony, but he spent most of his life in London, and he saw that as one of his most important pieces. That was his second symphony, Vaughan Williams' London Symphony, performed here at the BBC Proms by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, led by Leslie Hatfield, and conducted tonight by David Appleton. And he's back, returning to the stage, David Appleton, this orchestra's former principal guest conductor, bringing the players of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales to their feet. And David Appleton, a conductor with getting on for half a century under his belt at this festival, celebrating 45 years since his first appearance here at the BBC Proms. And warmly thanking and congratulating the players of tonight's orchestra. BBC National Orchestra of Wales, this is their last prom here this season. They're off on holidays, but don't worry, they're back. Proms in the Park from Caerphilly Castle on the 7th of September. Well, that performance of Vaughan Williams' London Symphony, just about wrapping it up for this prom for tonight. Great to have had your company for this very special concert this evening, where we've been uniting the music of India and the UK, and indeed uniting Radio 3 and the BBC Asian Network for the very first time. We will be back here live at the Royal Albert Hall at around 25 past 10, that's in an hour or so, for the very first six music from Radio 3 hooking up with another of the BBC's digital networks for a voyage of musical dialogue and discovery. It's all happening here tonight, I can tell you. For now, though, let's go back to Broadcasting House and join Ian Skelly.
Susie, thank you very much indeed. Susie Klein with our first prom of the evening. As she said, we'll be back a little while once they've reset the stage for that rather interesting late night prom, including music by The Stranglers and Verez, Berio, John Adams and Anna Meredith. Quite a combination, all from about 25 past 10 tonight. If you didn't catch the whole of this evening's first prom, though, do listen again via the Radio 3 website if you can. Even if you did hear the Vaughan Williams, do go and listen to it again. There can't really be anything more beautiful than that second movement in the London Symphony. If you want to hear the whole of the prom on the wireless again, then you can do so on Thursday afternoon from 2 o'clock here on Radio 3 in the next, not quite the next of our proms repeat programmes. Tomorrow afternoon, it's a second chance to hear last night's prom, which included the premiere of Mark Antony Turnage's new piece, Freeze, and one of those delightfully fixed points in the BBC prom season, a performance of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. More Vaughan Williams, too, towards the unknown region. It was the final concert in the tour by the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, always one to look out for, along with the National Youth Choir, of course, being a choral symphony. Top soloists, too, Lisa Milne, Jennifer Johnston, Andrew Kennedy and Gerald Finley took part, all conducted by Vasily Petrenko. You can hear it tomorrow afternoon, 2 o'clock, here on BBC Radio 3.
It hasn't been heard at the proms in more than 35 years. Sir Michael Tippett's opera, The Midsummer Marriage, his answer to Mozart's The Magic Flute. The tale of two couples tested by a series of supernatural interventions on the shortest night of the year. Conducted by one of today's leading exponents of Tippett's music, Sir Andrew Davis, The Midsummer Marriage. On Friday at 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Tomorrow, by the way, Radio 3 will be at the BBC Proms bringing you a feast of Russian music. The London Symphony Orchestra will be playing a symphony by Borodin, his second, and a piano concerto by Glazunov, his second. Daniil Trifonov will be the soloist. And in the second half of the concert, the music of a more recent Russian, Sofia Gubaidulina, before a tour of the exhibition that so inspired Mussorgsky to write his original piano piece that then prompted Ravel to orchestrate it. All live here on the home of the BBC Proms, BBC Radio 3. Well, stay with us for a trip to Caithness to retrace the steps of the writer Neil Gunn in search of the inspiration for his novel Highland River, after a sentimental saunter with Claude Debussy. Stephen Hough playing a piece Debussy originally called Promenade Sentimentale, better known to us as Clair de Lune. So, back to the BBC Proms at about 10:25 tonight. I say about because as I speak I can tell you much work is going on to reset things at the Royal Albert Hall for what will be a very different prom to the first one tonight, when we'll be joined by listeners to BBC Six Music, who are already broadcasting from the Royal Albert Hall at the moment. A combination of the Stranglers, Keris Matthews and the London Sinfonietta. So there is a chance we may be just a little later than advertised when they're ready for us. In the meantime, on Radio 3, a rather fascinating journey. We travel to the northeast corner of Scotland to celebrate the work of one of the country's finest novelists, Neil Gunn, who wrote of the Highland communities and landscapes of his youth, when he continued to reflect on these themes long after he'd moved away from the area. Well, the poet Kenneth Stephen travels to Dunbeath to retrace Gunn's steps and to find the setting of one of the best-loved works in Along the Highland River.
I'm in Caithness and I'm literally standing in the middle of a hailstorm. And I think about Caithness because I've been here many times before. Actually, I remember what many locals have said to me in the past, that everything important blew away from Caithness a long time ago. And it's somehow, you have that sense of the wind having blown things. It's a higgledy-piggledy bit of country with old roads and old barns and old places. It's the top right-hand corner of Scotland. It's jutting right out into the wildness of the North Sea. And somehow or other that's important too, the Norse character of it and the fact that all round your feet, to left and to right, are Norse place names, Norse heritage, a Norse sensibility. Coming away from a wild grey coast, you have vast moorlands rising up into great grey slabs of hill jutting up into the sky. I'm standing beside the sea where the river that has come from the inland hills flows out into the wild waters of the North Sea, and they are wild today. And all round me, on either side, are bits of this scattered community that make up the village of Dunbeath. And this place here in Caithness was the birthplace of the great 20th century Scottish writer Neil Gunn. And Dunbeath was the backdrop to a number of his works, notably to his great novel, the one that I'm here to discover, Highland River.
Highland River has many meanings. Of course, it is a river. It exists, only 10 miles long. But I think because of that, it has an intimacy about it that larger rivers probably wouldn't have. And the river was divided into reaches. And of course, this became analogous to life as well. And the principal character, you read about him as a child, as an adolescent, and as a fully mature man, and more than that, as a graduate, and a distinguished graduate at university. So the river and the man are intertwined.
The voice of Dermot Gunn, nephew of Neil Gunn. Highland River was penned at the height of Neil Gunn's career. He was born in Dunbeath in 1891, and the vital early years of his childhood were spent in this corner of the far northeast of Scotland. For many years he didn't write full-time, but had to rely on a career in customs and excise for his living. It was the success of Highland River, published in 1937, that changed all that. There are three main streams that flow together to make the one river of the story. The first part comprises childhood and all the flashes and flickers of memory that make up this growing up in a far northern corner of Scotland. The second stream is that of the First World War and the strange landscape of Flanders that somehow becomes for Ken, the main protagonist, a weird reflection of his childhood land. The third and final stream is the grown man's return to the place where he grew up and to the strath he has carried with him through the years, to follow the river he remembers backwards, to its beginning. Professor Douglas Gifford of Glasgow University has written widely on Gunn.
Highland River certainly has things to do with Gunn's growing up and life. There's no question. It's set in Dunbeath. It's where he grew up. The father figure, the bless me boy, bearded fisherman, is clearly modelled on his own father. But there's no question it's a novel. And to do that, I think he had to revisit, just as Ken revisits, Ken the boy in the novel, just as Ken revisits his childhood, so Gunn felt that he had to explore philosophically, I don't use that word lightly, philosophically he had to explore what he believed in.
I've moved up from the harbour and the sea, really to the first stretches, the first wilder stretches of the Dunbeath water, and away also from the mighty arc of the A9, the motorway heading into the far north, which crosses the water lower down. And here, I'm thinking also of how this place must have been, how it's changed since Neil Gunn's own childhood a century ago. With windmills on hills and oil rigs out in the North Sea, which are visible from down at the sea. At this point, though, where I am now, and these first reaches, it's actually back to what it must have been. I imagine him and his childhood friends wandering about exploring the magic, the wonder of this bit of water and all its treasures.
Well, my name is George Bethune, and I was born and brought up in Dunbeath. I was born down in what we call the village there in 1940. When I read Highland River, first of all, I thought it was a wonderful read, but I was a little bit annoyed because I thought that I was the first boy in Dunbeath that had done most of the things that Neil Gunn had written down many, many years before that. He talks about the eels, catching the eel by the tail and it forming a knot. When I was a boy, not every year, but some years, the river absolutely teemed with millions and millions of elvers. It all disappeared. Why? Never see eels there now. He talks about eating the primroses. Well, we used to do that. He talks about the serpent field behind the mill. Well, we knew that if we went in there, not only would we see grass snakes, but you would see the odd adder. He talks about, and this made a really big impression on me, talks about the grasp of the wood. I remember going up the strath and going into the woods and my mum having to come up and shout, "George, come home for your tea or come home for your dinner." Yes, we tramped the strath.
I think about the wonder of that opening chapter of Highland River and how I read it when I was about the age of its hero, Ken. It's the most exciting beginning to any novel that I know. A boy is asked by his mother to get water from the well. He goes out in his bare feet, rather moodily, the bucket bumping at his knee, and suddenly everything stops as he sees in the well pool a salmon swirling about that water. He drops the bucket. Everything rises within him as he rushes to be able to catch that fish. He arrived at the well, which was at the foot of a steep bank by the side of the river. Carelessly, he bumped the pail down on the flat stone, and at the sound, as at a signal in a weird fairy tale, the whole world changed. His moodiness leapt right out of him, and fear had him by the throat. For from his very feet a great fish had started ploughing its way across the river, the king of fish, the living salmon. Ken had never seen a living salmon before, and of those he had seen dead, this was beyond all doubt the All-Father. When the waves faded out on the far side of the stream, where the bed was 3 feet deep, Ken felt the great silence that lay upon the world and stood in the midst of it, trembling like a hunted hare. So intensely did he listen to the silence that he might well have caught a footfall a mile away. But there was no slightest sound anywhere. His eyes shot hither and thither, along horizons, down braes, across fields and wooded river flats. No life moved, no face was watching. Out of that noiseless world in the grey of the morning, all his ancestors came at him. They tapped his breast until the bird inside it fluttered madly. They drew a hand along his hair until the scalp crinkled. They made the blood within him tingle to a dance that had him leaping from boulder to boulder.